All right. Thank you very much, Ryan Burrow. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on this Monday afternoon, a snowy day, I guess. I don't know what the big headline. The big headline is NCAA tournament, right? I think we talked to the Inno people on the Monday afternoons. Caris Husted and Jim Dahlke are here. The boss, Will Flanagan. Well, he wanted to take in some snow, so he's out in Boston this week. Welcome to you both.
Thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
All right, so we just were having a riveting discussion off the air about the conference tournaments and the NCAA tournament. And Caris, you really don't have a dog in the hunt.
I really don't. Yeah, Loyola lost the first in what I like to call the pre-bracket tournaments. I believe they're called the conference tournaments, but they didn't do well.
We got that through to you today. They are called conference tournaments, right? Or not pre-brackets, but that's okay. Dahlke, who I don't know really if he graduated from anywhere, but he's claiming three different schools.
I got all my dogs are in the fight. UNCW, Northwestern, my schools, and then where I grew up, Chapel Hill, UNC got the one seed, so I'm feeling pretty good.
Right, so you went to Medill, right?
I did.
Yeah, so I'm really happy for you guys.
Yes, journalism Twitter is kind of freaking out right now at Northwestern's first appearance.
I was watching it yesterday after they'd announced the first three regions and had not announced Northwestern yet, and on Twitter. Boy, there's a lot of hate going on there, too.
Yeah, if Northwestern didn't make it, I think you would have seen like some sort of journalism riot happen. Right. Yeah.
Okay, and so we don't have time to talk about the fact that you can't really claim North Carolina just because you live there.
Well, maybe we'll cover it next week.
Maybe we'll cover that next. Well, they might not be in the tournament by next week, so we'll see.
Those are strong words, Steve.
So at Chicago Inno, they cover the tech world and innovation world in Chicago. And in a timely way, then you guys have looked at some sports startups in Chicago. And I love this story. I want to talk about a couple of them with Northwestern connections, but let's start with Bait, because I'm going to talk to Joe Gagliano a little bit later in the show. He is a bookie or former bookie, so he's going to talk all about filling out brackets with your money. Bait is a way you can make a bet with a buddy.
Yeah, Bait is a Chicago startup, and they've really sort of found the loophole around the whole illegal sports gambling thing. They make gambling very social with your friends, and they do it actually in a legal way. So their app links up with all the betting lines in Vegas, and I can bet with you, Steve, and I can say, all right, I think North Carolina will make the Final Four, whatever bet we want to make.
Sure.
And then when they do, you have to pay me. But what it does is it pays you through Venmo, and there's nothing that's really kind of forcing you to pay up. It's sort of a man's bet. You got to pay up on your own. So it gets around these sort of legal issues by not deducting money from your account.
So there's no official exchange
exactly
through that.
But what it does
app.
Provide is a platform to actually make it happen. So you can see the bets on your phone, on the app, and then pay someone through Venmo.
Caris, you going to be participating in that at all?
I think beginner's luck is something I hear happens, so I guess I'll give it a try.
It is, so why don't we engage in a few bets? Let's try that, see if beginner's luck works for you. I was thinking of this morning, because this is the time of year when we used to be overwhelmed with ads from, I can't even remember the names of the companies. Is it FanDuel, or remember the two sort
of... DraftKings and FanDuel,
Draft
right.
DraftKings and FanDuel. Are they just gone altogether now?
Well, we just saw last week DraftKings raised another $100 million. So those companies combined last year, and now they are sort of ramping back up. I don't think that they are going to be dead. You're seeing them less on the sides of buses these days.
Right.
Their ad spend is definitely down. But I don't think the appetite for that kind of gameplay is going away.
So they had to reconfigure, though, to comply with laws? Is that what happened?
They're kind of morphing into what they're calling a sports entertainment company, so that's a little bit ambiguous right now. So I think what you're going to see is they're going to still just sort of do the daily fantasy, but I think that might sort of evolve into sort of more of an online kind of gambling, sports entertainment sort of entity.
Okay, let's do the Northwestern things now. There's Rise Science, which we've talked about before, right? These are guys and women who studied sleep and took it to Northwestern's football team first.
Yeah, so Rise Science is doing some really interesting things around studying sleep and how much sleep you need. So they basically make tailored sleep schedules for professional athletes, and they sell this kind of technology to pro teams to help their players sleep at the exact amount.
And
they
started on campus, but they've got some pro deals now too.
Oh yeah, they're working with the Bulls, the Jacksonville Jaguars, they're working with a handful of college Division I college teams as well. And they found that there is no performance-enhancing drug like sleep. No medicine, nothing you can take will make you perform better than a right night's sleep.
It's amazing to see them successful there. So there's that. And then the other thing I really like is this Z-Crude. Who can tell me about Z-Crude?
Yeah, so Z-Crude is basically bringing predictive analytics to recruiting.
So we spend so much time on the other side of it. In fact, last week you talked to a guy about how to get a college scholarship, how to be recognized. This is on the other side, right? The schools, how to figure out if the people you're recruiting are going to actually show up at your school.
Yeah, because recruiting is a pretty difficult game, you know, because the earlier you start, you know, say you start recruiting a player in when they're in eighth grade, the more likely they are to actually go with your college. But the difficulty is, how well do you know that 14-year-old is actually going to play as well as their promise, you know, if they're going to live up to their promise. So basically what Z-Crew does is they use a confluence of predictive analytics to find out how likely a recruit will commit to that university. They actually worked with Northwestern's football team in 2015, and they were able to predict whether a player would commit with 94% accuracy.
So what did they look for? Do you know the particulars?
So they declined to say the exact factors they use because they said it's all proprietary.
The recipe?
Exactly. Secret sauce. They do customize algorithms for different universities, though, so you can imagine that certain universities might want to weigh certain factors more heavily. So, for example, if a player's relative went to that university, chances are they'll probably have a better connection to that university, making them more likely to commit there.
Or if you grew up in that state, you might think that's actually your team.
Location, certainly. And then, I mean, you know, the GPA requirements too, right? So, I mean, if it's Stanford, for example, they're going to have a different GPA requirement than, you know, the University of Georgia,
so,
for example.
So, Karras, the North Carolina guy, either missed the reference or he's just not going to play.
I'm blowing right past.
Box score games. Tell me about this one.
Yeah, box score games is bringing sort of live gameplay, like if I were watching the March Madness tournament, but they're bringing like sort of a side component to your phone.
Okay, so this has got to stop. This is where we have to pull back, because I kept telling myself and anyone who'd listen that all I want to do this weekend is sit and watch the Wisconsin-Michigan game. That's all I want to do. I want to sit, not with the phone, and I couldn't do it. I had my phone. I'm checking Twitter. I'm doing all these different things. Sounds like this is... So this is where you sit in front of a game, but watch your phone doing other things while you're sitting in front of a game.
It's all about the second screen, Steve.
Yeah, right.
So basically what Box Score does is they have a suite of different games. One of their games actually during the football season was called Fantasy Pizza. I believe we talked about this back in the fall, but basically they let you play this sort of fantasy pizza game during a live NFL game. So you select, like, okay, I think that the Patriots are going to score 40 points. And if they end up actually do scoring 40 points, you get a pizza.
Which is
delivered
great.
To your house, right?
You're going to get the pizza anyway. You know, why not get it for free?
Okay, and so this is all legal on the up and up and something that's growing.
That's right. They are partnering with Miller Coors, and they're going to be advertising a lot inside Buffalo Wild Wings. So Buffalo Wild Wings is going to get you playing box score games in the restaurant while the tournament's going on.
You know, when I was growing up, I always thought I wanted to be a big-time play-by-play announcer, but now no one knows who they are, you know, because they don't listen to them. They can't hear them and all of that. So
yep, turn the sound off and pull up Fantasy Pizza.
Used to be the radio. Listen to the radio. Okay, that's Jim Dahlke, Karras Husted in the studio from Chicago Inno. When we come back, Karras is going to talk about a story she wrote where everything you need you can buy with the palm of your hand. It's 12:53. This is not right. It's 12:23. This is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. We changed our clocks this weekend, Jim, but not that much.
Get the extra 30 minutes?
Yeah. Jim Dahlke and Karras Husted are in here from Chicago Inno. All right, Karras, you wrote this story that, well, they're kind of focusing on Wicker Park, right, for the experiment of it. But the idea is that it's a software or a payment system where you pay not with your eye or your thumbprint, but with the palm of your hand. Explain that for me.
Yeah, so this is
Good afternoon. I'm Jill Egan.
Keo, and basically what it does, it allows you to pay with your palm. It connects a biometric identifier that's basically the unique pattern of veins in your hand to make sure it's you. It connects to your credit card. All you do is put your hand over their device. It takes a quick, I'd say, 2-second scan, and you're done. You don't take out your wallet, don't have to use cash or anything.
So it's different from a print. It's actually looking at blood vessels. So I would imagine it's scanning. How does it know? I mean, it must look deeper than just skin level, obviously.
Yeah, which is actually really important because external biometrics, such as a fingerprint, iris scan, or facial recognition scan, that's actually really easy to replicate. You know, someone could just take your fingerprint, find a way to, you know, copy it, and then use it to pay for things. And
sure, we've seen Mission Impossible. We know how it works.
Exactly. Yes, all the very accurate tech future movie.
Right.
And so what's interesting is that each person has a unique pattern of blood vessels in their hand. And so in addition to having a unique pattern of blood vessels, it also requires that your hand also has moving blood within it. So, you know, you don't have to worry about someone chopping off your hand and paying for their coffee with your hand.
And coffee's expensive, too, so that would be a real concern.
Yeah, it would. It adds up over time.
And so are these guys based in Wicker Park, or they're just running the sort of the... trial in Wicker Park?
Yeah, so they are based in Wicker Park. But what is really interesting is that there have been Palm payment startups before that have basically come and failed. And so what Kio is trying to do differently is create habits with customers at the places that they're going most often. So coffee shops, you know, corner stores, because they realize that getting people, getting Palm payments into people's daily lives is going to be really important for accepting a very new age kind of crazy
tech.
Yeah,
so I'm just wondering how they would start. I mean, I guess they would have to start with the shop, right? If you're a regular at the shop, they're going to sort of solicit the payment.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, I think the biggest barrier to that sort of business model is getting your devices into all the stores that you need, right? Like, you need to get a large adoption into as many stores as you can if you're really going to kind of scale a business like that. And I think it's just kind of getting people more comfortable to the idea that, like, yes, Palm payments are real, they are safe, they're working in this store, and then we're trying to expand it elsewhere.
But going on the merchant side as well, they're actually doing just a 1% processing fee, which is really important because apparently for small businesses, they have to go into these processing negotiations, it's 3-5%. And right. If you think about that on every cup of coffee, that really does add up. So they're trying to really bring small businesses into this from the beginning so that they also become advocates for explaining this technology to the customer.
And they say that buying a cup of coffee is just the start, right? You're going to start to do all kinds of other things with your hands.
Yeah, they have a very ambitious worldview. Basically, they want to take anything physical that you could lose, which I do rather often, such as, you know, tickets. You won't have to worry about showing up to the concert. Oh, I lost my ticket. And then you can't get in. They thought about turnstiles, for example, on the CTA. You just have to scan your palm and you go. But again, they want to start with commerce because that's kind of the first stage of all of this biometrics.
It seems like with so many of these things that you see young startup companies that may not be the ones there at the finish line, but they're a sign of what's to come. I mean, this probably is going to be how we transact in the future.
Yeah, right? I think it's likely. I mean, because we were just talking off air that credit cards are really easy to lose, you know, and they're really easy. A number is an easy thing to replicate, whereas something that's in your palm is something that is, you really can't replicate that.
Although we all said, too, that wearables were going to be the thing of the future, and they seem to be failing.
Yeah, it's really tough to predict. You know, this whole tech thing is tricky to sort of nail down.
It's going
to
keep you in the money, Dalkey.
Look, we've talked about how, you know, the Apple Watch was supposed to be the next greatest big thing, and it sort of wasn't. Wearable device sales were down. Fitbit, you know, fired over 100 people after they had a kind of weak holiday sales season. We're sort of seeing this trickle down into the startups that we cover here locally who are in the wearable space. Rhythmio, which is a software maker for wearable devices, they launched in 2013. Raised over $3.5 million. They are shut down. And Karis covered a startup, Poliera, which is another wearable company that laid off a bunch of people and is pivoting a bit.
Yeah, so Poliera promised in 2015 to have the first truly flexible display. So you could literally take this smartwatch and twist it up and the display would still work. Promised to have it out in 2016. We didn't hear anything from them. I checked with them last week and it turns out they're folding into another company and now they're not going to do the product side. They said it was really hard to raise money for a consumer product and just kind of get this out to the general public.
That's Karis Husted, Jim Dalkey, both from Chicago Inno. Thanks very much for coming by today.
Thanks, Steve.
Okay, North Carolina plays Northwestern. Who do you choose?
Carolina. I'm from Chapel Hill.
You went to Northwestern?
Yeah, it was just a year program, though.
All right, we'll take a break. I'll beat them up. This is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you very much, Ryan Burrow. Steve Bertrand here. All right, do you have your brackets filled out? Kind of quick if you do, but we will talk a little bit later in the program with Joe Gagliano. He is the author of a book called No Gray Areas. He's going to give us tips, I guess, on our brackets, but he's also a former bookie and was involved in the Arizona State point shaving scandal. So a little conflict there. I'm not sure how I feel about that. Randy Schaefer is in the studio. She writes about social media for the Chicago Tribune. Randy, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I love the what we're going to talk about today, a couple of different views of Facebook in the workplace. And the first is an essay or an op-ed piece written by David Kalt, who is the CEO of Reverb.com, who says one of the first things he does is friend his new employees on Facebook.
Yeah, and that's becoming increasingly more common. I know in my first job out of college, I had 6 or 7 friend requests waiting for me before I even got to my first day. And these were all from people that had been there forever, that had seniority, bosses. So it's becoming a pretty common thing. I don't know if you have a lot of employees that you friend.
I don't have any employees, first of all. If I did, I suppose I would friend them. But I mean, it goes sort of, doesn't that go contrary to what we've always been taught about keeping your personal life personal and your professional life professional.
Right. And, you know, as we progress, those lines are definitely blurring. I mean, people have cell phones, they answer work emails off the clock, and it's pretty much impossible to pretend that you don't have a life outside of work. Social media has become so pervasive that it's basically, it's an extension of your actual life.
Well, and, right. But the thing is, if you might want the freedom to post things on your Facebook page that you wouldn't necessarily want your boss to see.
Right.
That's the assumption.
That's the assumption. But there can also be another side, is that maybe you do these really cool community activities, or maybe you're a marathon runner, and maybe those are things that your boss needs to see. Maybe your boss needs to see what gets you out of bed in the morning, what motivates you. Maybe your boss needs to see that you're a real person, and social media can definitely help a CEO kind of see these things.
I think it probably, as I read it and think about it, it's like, well, in the most healthy of situations, it's all good, right? Why the cult that says, well, why, you know, you want to know just that, what motivates your employee. You might think of this worker as the woman who does this, not necessarily as the mom who loves to take her kid to hockey practice or to paint or the weekends or things like that.
Exactly. And kind of on that flip side, though, you know, you said in the best circumstances, people can be abusing this, you know. And so this is a good example. Remember your privacy settings. You can have on Facebook different lists for different people. So you can share different photos with your college friends than different photos with your coworkers. And this is something I do, where I have various lists set up where I know my coworkers don't want to see any of my college memories when I share them.
I do, actually. I'm disappointed I don't have access to those.
I'll have to add you to that list then.
The other thing Cult says, which I think is interesting, now am I pronouncing his name correctly? Yeah, David Cult, is that it works for him too, in that he can, because his employees are his friends on Facebook, they see things about him and sort of humanizes him for the worker as well.
Right, absolutely. And that's definitely the flip side, where it can be kind of hard sometimes. You know, you see your boss, you get in at 8, you leave at 5, and you just see this guy telling you what to do. But this is a great idea. You can see that he's a person too. You know, he worked hard. He has a home life. He has things that interest him outside of work. And it kind of comes down to a reminder that everyone's human.
I guess it comes down to just a degree of maturity. I mean, if you're not posting pictures about, you know, of yourself at 4 a.m. coming out of the bars, that can get you in trouble. But if you're doing things that you want everyone to see, then everyone benefits from it.
Absolutely. And if you have cute dogs, that's also a bonus.
It depends on who you talk to. It depends on how you talk to those cute dogs, I guess. Okay, that's that. You just said flip side. Here's another flip side, though, because social media postings actually keeping, I know there's a piece in Vox that says, Vox.com, that one of the reasons the Trump administration hasn't filled so many jobs is because they're going through people's Facebook posts. Explain that for me.
Well, and this is like social media 101. You don't talk trash about your company or your boss on social media. But this is actually interesting, because the Trump administration has reportedly been asking for passwords and going through past posts that have been critical of Trump. And these aren't just people that are currently working for Trump that are bad-mouthing him behind his back.
Right.
These are, you know, people like Kellyanne Conway, who used to work for a Ted Cruz super PAC and was very critical of Trump, or people like Rick Perry, who called Trump a cancer. And
but they're getting jobs.
Exactly. And so this is kind of people, they're like, well, is this actually how we're filling positions, or are we using this as an excuse as to why we haven't hired these people, like a convenient excuse? Oh, you said this, we're not going to hire you, kind of thing.
Oh, so you're saying they're going through the Facebook post, and maybe it's someone they're trying to find a reason not to hire them.
It could be, and that could be the excuse as to, you know, why they're not getting hired. But it is it's very arbitrary. They're kind of picking and choosing their arguments there.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll watch that. And that is an issue in Washington, that there are so many, especially at the State Department, I think, where there are so many positions that are unfilled right now. It's kind of a shell of a department, and it's becoming an issue. And maybe it's because of your like button on Facebook.
Maybe
I don't
it's
think
because
so.
Of your like or your angry button on Facebook.
While we're doing social media and all of that, the insurance. Now, my daughter, I think I probably told you I need to talk a little bit less about her on the air, but she's studying in Hawaii this semester and is just going gangbusters. She sent me a video last week of her, I'm not kidding you, jumping off of a cliff into the water. And she said it was 70 feet. Looked like it on the video.
You're still here, so you didn't have a heart attack?
Well, she showed me the video after it happened. Obviously, I knew she survived. And then yesterday she was diving in a shark cage in off the coast of Hawaii with these Galapagos sharks coming up to the cage and all of that. All right, that's great. She's adventurous. She's taking it all in. But there's a story you brought in that talks about how insurance companies are actually looking at some of this stuff and deciding whether or not to insure people by their social media posts?
Yeah, and this is kind of interesting because this is all public information, but it also presents a bigger argument. Can insurance companies decide that they want to charge you more because even though you have a safe driving record, you're posting a photo of your street racing?
How does this work? Because I got to figure that State Farm, or, well, here we are in the Allstate Showcase studio, right? They've got so many clients that they're not going through everyone's individual posts, right?
Right.
I mean, are these algorithms, or how are they looking this stuff up?
I don't know. And I mean, especially if your name is Jake Smith or, right, you know, Bob Thomas, they're going to have a really hard time finding you. But it's kind of just raises, I haven't seen any instances of this specifically happening, but it does kind of raise a broader question. Do insurance companies have the right to do this?
And what's the answer? I mean, they can charge me more for car insurance based on my zip code.
Right. And so it's the same when you fill out your health insurance forms. Are you a smoker? And they can charge you more for whether you're a smoker. And so I guess it's kind of a way of seeing whether people lie about that. If they're saying, no, I don't smoke, and their Facebook profile is a picture of them lighting up outside. And
well, and the insurance companies say, look, this has really helped us cut down on fraud, right?
I mean, right.
We might have someone claiming disability and we've got pictures of them bungee jumping, and fraud is bad and it's good that we bust these people.
Right. So I guess maybe it comes down to don't commit insurance fraud. Maybe that's the easiest way out of this.
Or just create a complete alter personality on Facebook, right?
Or Facebook privacy. Lock it down.
There she goes. That's the lesson for today. Randy Schaefer, all about Facebook privacy. She'll be hosting a seminar coming up next week.
I will be back at this time next week, yes.
This is the Business Lunch on 720. You're listening to the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, here's a quote from Joe Gagliano. There is black and white and right and wrong. If you can stay true to that, it's a pretty good life you're going to lead. He joins us on a phone line now. Joe, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hey, Steve, thanks for having me on. How are you doing today?
I'm all right. Okay, but I start with that quote to say this secondarily. Now, we're going to talk about brackets and how to fill out March Madness brackets, but you went to prison, right, for fixing college basketball games?
Boy, I did. I got sentenced back in 1999, I believe it was, and orchestrated and financed still to this day, the largest point shaving scandal in history.
What were you thinking, man? Was it just too easy, or what happened there?
Boy, I'll tell you what, I was a product of the environment, Steve. I was born and raised in Chicago, grew up on, you know, listening to WGN, so it's great to be on with you guys.
But we're number one among college bookies, I think.
Is that factual?
I don't know.
That would be great if you were. But, you know, I traded bonds at the Board of Trade in Chicago, Steve, and I was a product of that environment, a product of embracing the gray areas when I was young and impressionable. And, you know, kind of made a choice back in the 93-94 that has haunted me the rest of my life, and a choice that I certainly still regret.
You were walking around with a duffel bag with $3 million in it at one point?
Yeah, I'll tell you what, the third game, you know, there ended up being a total of four games. You know, first game bet a little over $1 million. The second game, you know, rolled the first game profits in. The third game rolled the profits from the second game in. And you know, last game had over $5 million bucks on the game.
And this
so
all,
there were four games total.
You talked about taking advantage of the situation. I mean, there was a player on the team, right, who had gambling debts and needed some way out of it.
Yeah, my brother was going to school at Arizona State, and like I said earlier, Steve, I was at the Board of Trade in Chicago, so I'd fly out to visit my brother on campus quite a bit. And a guy that lived next door to him in the apartment complex on campus was a bookmaker and dealt with college kids as his clientele, and one of his clients was Stevan Headache Smith. Stevan Smith was the point guard for the ASU team. Bill Frieder was coaching them that year, and they had a really good team. They had a decent team. Let's put it that way. They were slated to make the NCAA tournament, and Headache got into the bookmaker for about 25 or 30 grand and wasn't able to pay his debt. And you know, I was able to concoct a plan where, hey, I'll forgive this debt for you, and in addition, you can make some money. But I need you to give me the outcome of two games. And you know, greed kills, and two games turned into three, and three games turned into four. He recruited the other guard on the team, so I had the two guards. So I pretty much controlled where the ball went and who the ball went to, and you know, it was a successful plan there for a couple games, that's for sure.
Got away with it for a few years.
Yeah, many years after the fact. In fact, I thought the whole thing died down pretty hard. There was a lot of rumors and speculation after game four went down, but you know, nothing really came of it other than a bunch of speculation. And about 3 years after the fact, two guys on the ASU campus, both of which I would not know if I was sitting next to them in a room today. One guy got in trouble for drugs, I guess driving a trunkload of pot up to Tucson, and the other guy got in trouble for some credit card schemes, using stolen credit cards to buy electronic equipment and sell them back to students. And, you know, both those kids knew enough about the ASU scandal to be dangerous, and both of them played Monty Hall, let's make a deal with the government, because the ASU piece was a lot more shinier for the government. Sure. And that's how they were able to bring down the indictments.
Okay, so there's that. That's the bad side. And Joe's written a book about it called No Gray Areas, did his time. How does a guy like me, how do I make a leap then from talking to a guy guilty of point shaving and then transfer it into a guy giving us advice about our brackets?
Well, one thing I know, Steve, and not in a braggadocious way in any way, shape, or form, but one thing I know and understand very well are all the nuances of sports betting and sports gambling. And, you know, so when you look at having a successful NCAA bracket and trying to beat other people inside your pool that you're playing against, I mean, what people don't get when they do this, or what they really don't factor in is everyone's going to have the usual suspects. Everyone's going to have the Kansases, the Kentuckys, the Dukes, the North Carolinas.
The Marquettes.
I don't know about the Marquettes.
Okay, I just thought I'd try.
It was a good try, though.
Thank you very much.
But, you know, everyone's going to have them in the Elite Eight, the Final Four, the championship game. And so you're really not going to surprise anyone. And if there was a surprise where a 7 to a 16 seed that made those things, that made those final pairings, chances are nobody else you're competing against is going to have them either. So it's going to level the playing field. Where you're going to do some damage and where you're going to have some success in your pool is picking up the early points in rounds 1 and 2. And my opinion is, my humble opinion is, don't be predictable. Don't be predictable in always picking these upper seeds, these higher seeded teams.
Okay, but wait, so you also say that, you know, Cinderellas are, you know, are just that. It's hard to pick a Cinderella and ride a Cinderella. So how do you balance not being predictable and not putting, you know, all your stock in a Cinderella story?
Yeah, fair question. I think the Cinderella stories for rounds 1 and 2 are great picks, and you pick the teams that have momentum. Don't ever lose track of the fact that these are 18, 19, 20-year-old kids. They are wickedly talented athletically, but mentally they're probably lacking in a little bit of stability.
Right.
So if you get a kid that has momentum on his side, if you get a team that has momentum on their side, a team that has won, I love looking at the last 5 games that they've played, a team that has gone 5-0, a team that has gone 4-1 in the last 5 games that they've played, they've got momentum, they've got confidence on their side.
Okay, it would seem to me that this is a wide-open bracket this year, right? I mean, very unpredictable.
Boy, I think so. I think the parity in Division I basketball especially, all these kids are so wickedly talented. I think any one of these teams could beat any one of those teams 8 days a week on the right night. It just takes believing in them. It takes a little bit of confidence. And I believe, you know, some of these 5-12 matchups, these 6-11 matchups, these 7-10 matchups, don't be afraid to take the what's looked at and perceived it to be the inferior team if they have the right momentum behind them.
Joe Gagliano is our guest. The name of the book, No Gray Areas. Look, I appreciate your candor in talking about all of this, and I wish you the best of luck.
Hey, Steve, I appreciate the time. Okay. Take care of yourself.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Coming up after a break, we say hello to an old friend who never really went that far away.